Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse MLL Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined as always by Kyle Devitt, and we have yet another exciting week of MLL action to discuss as we've got 8 weeks in the books. We've got all-star selections to discuss. But Kyle, we're going to start with an overtime thriller. Charlotte Hounds, 16. Chesapeake Bayhawks, 15 from Memorial Stadium. It was an interesting doubleheader situation that the CBS Sports Network had lined up there, and really enjoyed this one. Thought that, you know, the Bayhawks showed early how good they are, how good they can be. But the Hounds, after struggling, in my opinion, offensively early, did a nice job of rebounding in the second half and ultimately hung around until taking the game to overtime by getting a P-point on goal with about 3.5 minutes to go. And then Ryan Young sealing the deal in overtime.
Yeah, it was a great game. Looking back, sometimes I retroactively scroll back through Twitter to look at fan reactions, and our own Matt Kinnear was like, so didn't think this game would be this close, because at one point I think it was like 9-4 at one point in the second quarter before Charlotte scored a goal, and then Chesapeake scored a goal, and Charlotte scored a goal to end the half. And at that point you were kind of like, well, I don't really know where this game's going, because one of the goals was assisted by Mason Poley, who actually was amazing in the first half of this game.
Yeah, he was their offensive MVP in the early going.
Yeah, he was excellent, picking up the ball, going right to Cage, and Chesapeake hoping that Turner would save a shot because they didn't waste a slide on him. Didn't work twice. Worked a third time, even though he passed it for an assist. I think Chesapeake kind of thought the same thing that I thought, which is, we got this. It's in the bag. Let's just go out and play a little bit. We got it. Danowski's not on. We're gonna take care of this. We're gonna be good. And that was an incorrect assumption, as Mr. Danowski went off. And it's funny because he got quote unquote snubbed from the All-Star thing, and everyone's like freaking out, and it's like, nah, he couldn't play anyway. He had a previous commitment, I believe related to coaching, but I haven't confirmed that independently. So people were kind of freaking out about that, but especially after this game, when they announced it on Monday. But, it was a great game to watch. Charlotte did what they always do. They make that second half adjustment and come out as a better team. And I think they attacked much more fluidly from X and allowed Danowski to be the primary ball carrier, moving the ball instead of top down from the back up and carrying to the wing, looking for rollbacks, looking for good matchups, and they took advantage of it, and Chesapeake just couldn't keep up. I think Chesapeake was stagnant and didn't really, score. If you look at the guys that scored their goals, it wasn't their Dodgers. It was Junior and Westervelt, getting goals off of someone else working really hard, and those guys that were working really hard weren't scoring. McCready's wasn't scoring in the second half. I continue to think, by the way, that he is just awesome. I think he's an awesome player, and he should get more run than some of these other guys that are in this Chesapeake team, especially after this game. I think he looked real good, so fast, and just really strong on the ball, especially opposed to a couple of the guys that are even on the All-Star team from Chesapeake.
Interesting. Okay, well, we can come back to that in a second, but I want to talk a little bit about what I saw out of Charlotte's offense in the first half. And that is, and it doesn't surprise me, because they're a really young team, a lot of guys trying to make a name for themselves offensively. And there are some guys that are doing it in, I guess, a little bit speedier fashion than others. And also, the fact that Mike Sawyer and Eric Lesby went to college together, is it just me, or do they spend a lot of time throwing the ball between themselves, and then Matt Danowski and Pete Poyan spend a lot of time throwing the ball between themselves? And it just struck me that, and this was like, this is probably like a 3 or 4 possession span in the second quarter, it just struck me that it felt like a lot of guys were afraid that if they gave the ball to somebody, they weren't going to get it back. Do you get that sense?
Yeah, but I always feel that way when guys like Danowski and Poyan are playing. Like, all right,
you feel like their teammates think that if they give the ball to them, that they're not going to get it back?
Probably.
Which is like a fair criticism, right? And that's definitely one of the things that you need to balance. But I would imagine that in some instances, you know, you're okay with it because you realize, like, these are guys that have put up 40 and 50 points in their career. You know, they may take a lot of shots, but at the same time, like, you know, even if they're shooting 22 to 28%, which is a, you know, that's a range between mediocre to very good, they're still justified in going to the goal because they can score. Whereas, you know, if I'm a guy trying to make a name for myself, I don't know. It was just, it just struck me as like a little bit of a weird dynamic. And I wasn't sure if that was something that, like, with this team in particular, because you've seen them more than I have, yeah, if it was unusual or if it was something, because it seemed like they really did overcome it in the second half. There was a little bit more trust that the ball was actually going to spin. And I think that it was actually, you know, I felt like their extra man possessions did a nice job of getting a lot of different guys involved. And I think that one of the reasons maybe that was the case is because when you score a lot of transition goals, like they did in the first quarter, particularly when Mason Polley is getting those goals, as an offensive player, you're not getting the runs. You're not getting the ball on your stick. And you're just like, I need a shot. I need two shots. You know, I just need to get an opportunity to get in the box score.
Yeah. And also, you know, you say that, you know, they're probably okay with it because it produces results. You know, 7 points, Danowski, even though he shot 19 times, still 7 points, Danowski with 2 2-point goals, 2 regular goals and an assist. You know, that's, he's the difference in the game. He wins you the game. So you can't really be upset, but your point about touches and not trusting people, I think it's more that this team is, you know, this team is not afraid to move guys to practice squad. This team is not, they showed that with Jovan, who made his return in this game and didn't get a lot of runs, but was still, you know, dressed for on the sideline. And I think that this team is hyper competitive. You know, the one thing that strikes me about this team too is they give out numbers to their guys.
Well, hold on. One quick thing about that, which is, that is cool. Are guys getting sent to the practice squad because they're not performing or because they're not doing the right thing?
What do you mean by doing the right thing?
Doing what Cirino and his staff want them to do.
I think it's probably a mixture of both, depending on which case you're talking about. You know, I think defensively you haven't seen a ton of movement. You know, they've had a very core group of long poles. But then again, you know, they had a guy like Cudmore who was playing really well for the first four games and then was like, oh, we got Mason Polley now. We're good. See ya. You know, they had McCormick. McCormick, I don't believe, dressed for this game. They keep bringing in guys. You know, John Haas, they brought in for this game. Trapuka. They're moving guys up and around and trying guys out. And I think that what you're going to see more of in the more successful teams is having 25-man rosters that are strong and that you can rotate in case someone's injured. Not that it really relates to this game, but Stagnita was on the conference, the coaches call, talking about, you know, we want to get Sam Snow run. We want to get, you know, this guy run more, and we want to give Terry Kiminer more of a rest this week. You know, and it's kind of like, wow. Like, you're really thinking ahead.
I made this point in the August issue of the magazine too. That is what Hamilton had been trying to do the previous 2 weeks, and why I wasn't going to take an alarmist approach to the fact that they had lost those two games after, you know, reeling off 5 in a row. You know, Huntley was very pragmatic in his approach. This 5-game cushion, you only need to win 8 games basically in order to make the playoffs in the MLL. There's only been one team in the history of the MLL that's won 8 games and not made the playoffs. So if you are 5-0, and you know that you have 9 chances to win 3 games, you can afford to play with your roster and tinker a little bit. And, you know, he's a big proponent of the fact that I want to have my roster set by, you know, week 10, week 11, week 12. Well, that means that you've got 4 or 5 weeks to burn in between now and then. And, you know, I think that, and it's also difficult, you know, he was talking about it, and we talked about this on the podcast last week from the perspective of a 12-week season as opposed to a 14-week season. You know, this is probably the time of the year when, yeah, Stags and, you know, the other guys who know that they want their team to be in a position to make a stretch run and win games in championship weekend are looking up and down their roster thinking, all right, well, not only am I going to get an additional roster spot for championship weekend, but, you know, I want to know if somebody gets hurt on Saturday, who am I turning to on Sunday?
Right. Right. I would definitely, you know, subscribe to that theory and that practice. And I think Charlotte you know, is making a case for being, you know, the next upcoming team. You know, and there's other teams that are playing well too. I think it's strange how the form switches between all these teams. Like this team is playing well this week, and then this team is bad for 2 weeks, and then they're good again. I think it's weird. And I don't think it's just rosters. I think it's kind of a lot more tinkering with strategy and tactics, which I think is cool to see in the league.
Well, that's the coach in you saying that. I mean, yeah. there's also the side that says one guy had a particularly stressful week at whatever camp he was working, and as a result, he didn't play nearly as well. And that's not to say that that's a bad thing, because when you're a full-time lacrosse player, you know, you are working camps during the week. But, you know, that type of stuff does impact your performance, and in a star-driven league, a star's performance is only, you know, his poor performance is only going to be overcome so many times. You know what I mean?
I guess. Form is temporary, class is forever, you know.
I was going to say, I think you just made this point because you wanted to use your soccer terms.
Yeah, that too. I'm definitely not watching Spain, Italy right now in the background.
Well, let me flip this around before we jump off of the Charlotte Chesapeake game and actually put this question to Ben Rubior. But so how about like just the complete difference in 4-4? You know what I mean? How completely different Charlotte and Chesapeake feel right now, I would imagine. What's the size of the panic button that you're pushing on this Bayhawks team in terms of how likely they are to turn things around versus if you're Charlotte, you know, how much are you thinking in the back of your head that you've got a 3-5 Boston Cannons team that's got its sights set on your playoff spot?
Well, I think, you know, if you're talking this week, I think the panic button is relatively untouchable for Chesapeake. I mean, three of those losses are in overtime. You know, overtime losses are, you know, that's a bounce of the ball. You know, obviously it's the whole game and all that stuff, but you know, when you look at it,
speaking of the bounce of the ball, real quick,
yep.
How did Matt Zanowski get an assist on that overtime game winner?
I don't know. That didn't make a lot of sense to me either. But I don't keep stats. I don't even trust half the stats. That's why I watch the games. That's why I watch the games, man. I don't know. Ball hitting the ground, I guess. I don't know. That's weird.
It was it was clearly a shot that was saved and a rebound that was put back. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're right. That was definitely what happened.
All right, just making sure.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's talk to Ben Rubior.
Sounds good.
And the Inside Lacrosse MLL podcast continues with Chesapeake Bayhawk attackman Ben Rubior, an all-star this year. And Ben, you know, this Bayhawk squad coming into the season as defending champions, a very, almost a no-brainer pick in terms of, you know, being a Steinfeld Cup contender, and you guys got off to a hot start. And, you know, at 500 now at 4-4, coming off of what I would imagine is a disappointing overtime loss to Charlotte. How do you characterize where this team's at right now?
You know, I think we've played some good lacrosse in spurts. You know, I think we started out the season pretty well. We've had 3 one-goal games, including some overtime losses. And, you know, those are ones that in this league, you got to figure out how to win. But you know, it's a tough league. I think some of the younger teams in the league have done a really nice job. Hamilton has obviously done a nice job coming back with a good season. So, you know, we just got to figure out a way to right our ship to begin playing some better lacrosse, and you know, in some of these close games, figure out a way to make kind of one goal difference for ourselves.
Hey Ben, it's Kyle. My main question is just watching you guys play, looking at your roster. There's so many guys that can score one on one, and it kind of seems like you guys take turns scoring almost, maybe not on purpose, but in the flow of the game, different guys produce different amounts of goals. Do you think it's kind of might be a detriment to have that many guys that can go? And if you were going to pick one guy on your team to be the man to score the goal to win the game, who would it be?
You know, I think we do have some players that can score, and especially score in spurts. You know, we're trying to figure out how to, you know, get us all hot at the same time, and I think if we can do that, we're going to be in a good spot. In terms of scoring goals, I mean, I'd go with a guy that's been as consistent as anyone over his career, and probably John Grant Jr. I think he can do it in all sorts of ways. He's a very tough matchup, and when we needed some big goals, he scored them this year for us.
Ben, you're a guy who, you know, I've gotten to know a little bit over the course of your career at Virginia, and now, you know, just I've really enjoyed following your MLL career, you know, as a guy who I think in some ways has been almost on the periphery of mine in terms of premier offensive players. And, you know, this year, thanks to a couple of big, you know, point totals early in the season, you're kind of on the precipice of a career type year. What is different about the way you're playing this season, as compared to years past? And, you know, how much of it would you ascribe to being physical? How much of it would you ascribe to being mental? You know, particularly taking into account, your new role as a high school coach.
Right. You know, it's been a fun season. I will tell you that coaching has been a great motivation for me just to continue to work hard. And, you know, I see the effort that my boys at St. Mary's put in, and I feel like I at least have to match it. And you know, it's been a good season. I've had some guys that have believed in me. I've had some very good teachers and coaches kind of, you know, over the past 6 seasons. I've been in the MLO, and you know, I got to give credit to guys like Brendan Kelly and Dave Cottle for kind of believing in me and you know, helping me kind of figure out the MLL, which I think is a little bit different of a game than colleges.
Hey Ben, so I'm looking at these the All-Star roster and how many appearances people have made, and this is actually your first time you've been selected in the All-Star game. I kind of find that hard to believe, following your career over the past couple years, especially with your resurgence in Chesapeake. You know, I guess the standard, what does it mean to you question, to be selected to the All-Star game, especially if it's your first time?
Right. You know, it really is. It's a cool honor. You know, it's something that I've wanted to accomplish for a while. But at the end of the day, you know, I think our BayHawks team is one that does try and put the team first. And, you know, we're looking for wins as much as anything. So I've been blessed to be part of a very good organization, one that really does focus on, I think, the right things. And, you know, we've had some success over these past few years. And, you know, that's been the reason that I've stuck with this game, the reason I continue to work. And, you know, it's cool to be part of something where guys buy in and care about one another.
What's it like making the adjustment to playing without Danny Gladding?
You know, it's definitely different. You know, Danny and I think had a pretty good run together. I loved playing with him. He was a guy that really knew how to make guys around him better. In my opinion, kind of a quintessential X guy, could go both hands, was a good feeder, was always a scoring threat. I think he really helped me become a better player, and I enjoyed playing with him. So I've certainly missed playing with him, but you know, I think we got some good pieces, and we were rotating four attackmen this past season before. But you know, I think Westervelt and John Grant Jr. and myself have started to kind of click and started to play some good lacrosse together.
This Saturday, you're heading up to Hamilton. Maybe some revenge on your mind from that OT loss. They've got a bunch of really giant, not so quick defenders, kind of guys that maybe you can have success against. If you're going to pick a guy to guard you, which one would it be? And, you know, which one wouldn't want to guard you as well?
You know, I got to say, I think this Nationals team has really done a nice job defensively this year. They always have Brody Merrill, who is, you know, a force on defense, is able to get the ball up and off the ground and down his offensive end. You know, I look at a guy like Matt Lovejoy. He's a guy that I practiced against every day my senior year when he was a freshman. So, you know, these are guys I've played against before, and I think a very good defense with one of the best goalies in the league behind him. So, you know, we'll see how the matchups play out. You know, I would like to think that our attack creates some matchup problems, but we'll see how it plays out, and hopefully we can click for a full 60 minutes on offense.
Well, Ben, as the BayHawks prepare for a stretch run, second half surges are something that is familiar to this squad after winning the championship in 2010, and certainly fine playoff performances coming off of last year, in which you had, I believe it was 8 points in 2 games as a part of the 2012 championship Bayhawk squad. It's fair to expect some positive things ahead, I would think.
You know, I hope so. It's a league where I think, you know, the second half of the season really kind of makes the difference in how you feel at the end of the day. And, you know, we have had some success in the past. I don't necessarily think that means we're going to have it this year. We got to figure out a way to earn it. And you know, we're sitting at 500. I think we still got to, you know, we're still in a decent place, but we got to start clicking and hopefully get hot at the right time, because, you know, the end of the season's coming quickly, and that playoff weekend is important to us.
Well, we want to thank you again for joining us on the MLL podcast. Good luck this weekend, and hopefully we'll talk to you again down the line.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Well, Kyle, now that he's hung up, I want to thank one of the, in my opinion, classiest dudes in all of sport, Ben Rubior, who, you know, it's amazing. He's the type of guy that came into the MLL from Virginia at a time when Virginia Cavaliers were considered to be unreliable. There were a lot of reasons ascribed as to why. And the type of career he's put together, I think, is exactly what you wouldn't have expected from his predecessor 5 years earlier. So it was easy to see a guy like Connor Gill come in and be, you know, an MVP caliber player. But, you know, Ben's had a career where he's been asked to be a 25-point scorer year after year. He's not in the lineup in every game. You know, sometimes that's by, you know, his own volition, and sometimes it's not. And it just seems like he's always cool with it. And to me, for a coach to have a guy that, you know, is that skilled and you can rely on him to fulfill that role, how unbelievable is that?
Well, he's tough. He's tough, and he's coachable, you know. And I think the word you were looking for earlier, the UVA guys coming out in the mid-aughts, is soft. I think that was the word you were looking for. So I'll say it instead of you. It's fine. Everyone hates me already. But I've heard that term knocked about a bit, and Rubior is the opposite of that term. So, you know, I think that's why he's had a lot of success.
That makes a lot of sense. I'm not going to dispute that. Although, you know, one of the other things about that is that, like, you know, that's a reputation that has been, you know, pretty quickly shed. I mean, it's not as if there haven't been, you know, highly, you know, Virginia guys that, you know, a lot of people have gotten excited about in you know, since Ben's come out that haven't panned out. But, you know, whether it was Ken Clawson with his injuries or the Brattons, you know, going to LXM, there are also some guys that have come into the league that have done really well. And, you know, Ben mentioned one in Matt Lovejoy, who is very, 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 very tough. That kid is that's a guy that I don't know a lot of attackmen that like to stand next to him for 60 minutes. You know, I've heard Matt Lovejoy's name bandied about in terms of the types of players that, you keep your head on a swivel if you feel like he's going to, you know, come cross crease on you.
Yeah. No, that's the kind of player that coaches like too. You know, not necessarily for the penalties, but for the enforcement. You know, there's got to be a certain level of toughness that you display, especially in a league as competitive as the MLL.
So let's shift gears to a game that I actually didn't get a chance to see. The Boston Cannons, 16. The New York Lizards, 12. Lizards. John Tucker, now 2-0 as a head coach. Paul Rabel putting up a big one in this one. What were your thoughts on the Cannons' win? What does it say about, I guess, both these teams, where they're at in their season? You know, particularly kind of both coming off wins the previous week and I would imagine feeling pretty decent about the direction that they were heading. You know, we talked to Rob Pinnell last week. I don't know. I mean, it's a similar type of question to, you know, the difference between Charlotte and Chesapeake, you know, kind of having the same record but feeling different about their prospects, what they're doing. I mean, I'm not ready to count the Lizards out of the playoff picture by any stretch, but at the same time, I mean, I feel like it's a little bit easier to feel optimistic if you're a Cannons fan, because between the coaching change seeming to have worked and the history of this particular roster, or at least the core of this particular roster, there's more that you can feel hopeful about, right?
And also, you know, one of the things that I asked Tuck about on the call that we had yesterday was, you know, Matt Posque's reemergence with 5 goals that in my opinion were the difference in the game, not just by the scoreline, but the timing of them, how they were scored, how demoralizing they were, especially the two on the power play in the second quarter were really just kind of tough. I don't want to pile on. I really am not into piling on. But I don't get why Drew Adams is going to the All-Star game. That's not the Drew. Like, I know he's a good goalie. He's a great goalie. He's not having a good year. He did not have a good game in this game. He got shellacked twice by Chesapeake. I don't get how he's going there when guys like Galloway and Gittleman are like, you know, and the Rattlers aren't very good. And Galloway is clearly one of the best players on that team. You know, Gittleman is making routine saves from deep twos on Kyle Dixon make look easy, and he's not in it. And I think this game kind of showed that when Boston wants to get its shots, it has to rely more on individual matchups and then dumping and waiting for slides than a lot of other teams. And I think that I honestly think that the New York played them completely wrong. I just think they got it wrong tactically. And I think that they were exposed by Poske in particular.
When you look at this Lizards team from a big picture lens, what do you see that is most troubling that explains the difference between what they were at the end of last year versus what they are right now?
They need a poll. And it's not a comparative against last year. This team just needs a poll that can stop a guy. Cause I don't see any on the squad that can do that right now. You know, I think they have this weird mixture of guys that are fast, but not strong, and guys that are strong, but can't run. And that's, you know, that's what Hamilton had last year. And that's why Hamilton was bad. And I think that that's one of the things that they need to look at. They need to have a guy, not of the caliber, like we were talking about a couple weeks ago, not of the caliber of necessarily Lee Zink or Mike Evans. Like, they're not getting those guys, but someone that can, you know, throw a check and stay with the guy, and maybe someone that doesn't want to get matched up against them. You know, there are guys that have been played against this Lizards team specifically just to destroy certain guys playing defense. You know, there are certain matchups, and also there are, for all the talent on this team, it looks like, you know, a bunch of guys running around looking for deep shots. Like, look for layups. Don't, you know, make, there's a famous phrase that I have stolen from one of my mentors, Jerry Byrne. I haven't, you name dropped him on the podcast this year, but make 10 dime store plays instead of, you know, trying to spend a dollar and sell out. You know, make a bunch of little plays to add up to the big play. Don't just try and make the big play because, you know, you want to be the hero. Don't be the hero. And this team's full of heroes. And that's their problem.
Is there really anything else about this game? I mean, it almost feels like all right, now we're, you know, now we got two good teams that are 3-5 and they're chasing the pack. But I don't want to overreact to this result. So let's just see what the Canons and Lizards do going forward. And, you know, they'll separate one way or the other.
Yeah, and I think if you're looking at who's in a better position, I think it's Boston. Which, would you have said that 2 weeks ago? No, definitely not. They're playing better. Burke looked great, 16 saves. Spallina said on the call, again, to reference the coach's call, that Jordan Burke made 12 unbelievable saves out of his 16. And the other four were average. So if you're making 12 unbelievable saves, like, you should win the game. I don't think it was the difference in the game. I think Boston was comfortable throughout. I think Will Manny, you know, hey, who said Will Manny would be good? Who was the only guy? Who was that? It's this guy.
Wasn't it Quinn Kostic?
No. Oh, no. It was this guy. I'm pointing thumbs at myself. You can't see it. It's not a video podcast. Two thumbs up in the air. You know, he's doing really well, and he's in that role that he's going to have to flourish in, which is being the guy at X to help Boyle out, to bail him out of situations where maybe his lack of foot speed has gotten him trapped in a corner, and Manny is just comes out of nowhere, swoops in, you know, grabs the ball and runs to space. And he's done that really well, and he's produced points out of it. You know, he's a really good third attackman, just kind of like I predicted he would be.
Well, Kyle, let's move on to the third game of the weekend, the second half of the CBS doubleheader, head out to the Mile High City where the Denver Outlaws put up a 19 spot. They did the 19-goal rule. Are you aware of this, by the way? As a coach, if you were in a position where you had to observe this, would you? Which is, you don't score 20?
If I was on a team that could score 20, I would score 20. If I was coaching a team that could score 20, I would score 20 every time.
All right. Well, apparently it exists.
So,
and,
no.
on the flip side, the Ohio Machine put up 5. It was the ultimate game. It was the final game of the Garber era in Columbus. And, you know, not to pile on, but I was talking to a coach about, you know, a college coach about this game in particular and Ohio in general. And, you know, he was making some comments about how surprising it was that, you know, there wasn't more systems in place, you know, and how unclear their identity that they were striving for was. And I thought that there was one play that, in my opinion, was hugely influential with how this game unfolded that was a little bit indicative of some of the troubles that they had. And it was, I believe, Denver won the opening faceoff. Ohio got a stop. They cleared the ball. Ball was in Ray McGill's stick. He had cleared the ball, and he was, you know, trying to get it to an attackman to settle possession and get the offensive midfielders on as they were subbing through the midline. And at some point, the ball got worked back to him, and I believe both other offensive midfielders were on, but they wanted to initiate with Chaz Woodson, who was caught back on the defensive side of the midline because Ray McGill was using his, you know, his spot on the offensive half of the midfield. So he approached him at the midline, and so the Denver riding attackman was giving Woodson a little bit of pressure, and there was, you know, a funky exchange of the ball as McGill tried to step over and release Woodson onto the offensive half of the field. He muffed the ground ball. Denver picked it up, went the other way, goal, and then boom, before you know it, it's, was it 12-11? Or, I'm sorry, 12-11. 12-2 at going into halftime, 12-3 was the halftime score. I mean, you got Steele Stamick, work the ball to X and sub through the midline and then get things going. Is that not, is
you sound
that?
Like, you sound like everybody else that gets criticized for the simple solution, work the ball to Steele. And it's like, how can 50 people be wrong? How can 50 people be wrong? And the answer is, we're not. Just do it. It's the most obvious thing to do. And, is it like layman knowledge to do that? Like, I guess, but you know, in this game, it didn't matter because Steele was getting covered by Zink. He was getting zeroed out anyway. Like, you know, like move, carry the ball, invert, do something. You know, it's just, this team is, it's been hard to watch. I hope that they, you know, get better under Bear than they were under Garber. But is it really the tactics? Is it really the coaching when you only have one practice? Like, obviously, I'm a big proponent of it's always the, you know, the coaching. I think coaching is more and more important in the MLL. But is it that, or is it just that they're, you know, not producing and guys don't want to play on this team? You know, all the rumors, every trade rumor I hear has Ohio in it. You know, and the reason for that is guys don't want to play in Ohio. Sorry. And it's not that they don't like Ohio. Ohio's a great place, I'm sure. Aren't you from there? See, it produced Terry Foy.
I am from there.
It can't be that bad. So I think maybe the other stuff surrounding it, the intangibles of playing for this team that is 1-7 now? A team that's 1-7 isn't fun. Say it's not fun for anybody. If you can get out, why not get out? Go to a team, if you can try and win some games, feel good about yourself and feel like you're contributing to society instead of getting your face stomped in, like, try it. Like, it's going to be so hard to, like, rebuild a team that's already supposedly rebuilding, you know, like, well, with a new coach and a new philosophy.
And that's what's so interesting is that they have, you know, they have rookies who you want to build around. They have, you know, second, third, fourth year guys who you want to believe in, some of whom have local ties, you know, that could be good pieces. They need to figure out how to win more faceoffs, and, you know, Chase Guerrero hasn't totally been the answer yet. But they need to also figure out who are the veterans that they can rely on? And I think that Greg Bice and Anthony Kelly were supposed to be those guys, and for whatever reason it didn't or hasn't worked out. But who are the veterans who will provide a little bit of context, a little bit of leadership, and just get things pointed in the right direction alongside Bear? And it's a really tough question.
I don't think there are any. That's the problem.
And maybe there aren't.
I really think that that's the issue, you know? I think you're right about having guys that are pretty good on the team, offensively especially. But I think their biggest problem, as I've said from – I wrote a whole column on it. This is the worst transition team I think I've ever seen at any level. Running straight into doubles, not passing on a fast break. Like, you know, work for the layup. Keep saying it. Work for the layup. Work for the layup. Don't try and make all these like fancy moves and plays and break your guy down and make the crowd go ooh and ah. The only thing that should make the crowd go ooh and ah is when you put goals in the net. You know, and they can't do that. And until they can do that, I just kind of, you know, whatever. If the coach is the answer, sure. And you know, on the call, no one really asked him a lot of questions. I asked him two pretty strong questions. Do you have freedom to make moves is one. And he said, yes, but you know, it's him and Algie making moves. And then two, you know, if you make those moves, like, why are you making them? He's like, well, I'm putting in systems. And if guys don't fit, they're not going to play. And I'm like, oh, okay. That's a good thing to say. That at least gave me like, you know, at least you know that this is the situation you're in. You know, you have awareness of it. And I think that's important. So all the luck to him, but he's going to have to get some leadership somewhere. Because there isn't a lot on this team, and there isn't a lot of toughness or intelligence moving the ball in transition either.
It's probably enough on that. It was the depressing part of the podcast.
Yeah.
Anything out of Denver that, you know?
Denver's beast. I don't even know why we have to say anything about it. They're just awesome.
We don't, just and like, I'm really, happy to move on.
Yeah, really great team. Love watching them.
Last results of the weekend, Hamilton Nationals taking care of business against the Rochester Rattlers with a 17-11 win. One of those games that was pretty much never really in doubt, never really competitive, not close at half, not really close at any point in the second quarter. I'm sorry, second half. You know, kind of a bounce back game. Said earlier in the podcast that I thought to a degree, you know, the Nats had lost two games in which they were kind of tinkering with their you know, personnel a little bit. Brett Queener comes back from injury, makes 22 stops, allows 11 goals. I think he was a little upset that his save percentage had officially dropped below 60. He got that back in a hurry.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, with guys like the Lavelles on Rochester, you would expect better finishing. You just would. I mean, McIntosh too. But you know, they like to take, you know, the inside out game, and I don't think it works for them. I think they need to do what they did earlier in the season when they were pretty decent, when they had like Thomas Wood running in from the midfield, making some moves, making some shifty moves around the crease and dumping the ball. Team seems like allergic to easy finishes. You know, they always try to go high low when they're in tight, and I feel like every goalie in the league knows it. And Queener, no one drops faster than Queener in the league. Do you know what I mean? Like, as a goalie, no one drops down to that one knee position with the stick, you know, on either side of the knee or on the five hole.
Well, and nobody gets up faster and runs the 30 yards away faster either.
Agreed. I think it's, as far as shot stopping only though, I think you don't beat Queener going low on him. I mean, I just like, that's like a scout 101. I just feel like you don't even shoot low on Queener. Like, don't bother, you know, get him to drop and put it over. That's what you do with every goalie that drops. And I'm not saying he's like, that's like a weakness or anything. Like, he clearly saves balls high as well. Especially he's really good stick side. But I just watching this game, it was really evident that they kept going to the well of, hey, let's try and put it past him in a way that we look like we're dominating. We're going to put it past the point where he's the strongest. It looked stubborn to me. And maybe they just don't think that much into it. But if you're coaching that team, you got to be like, don't shoot low on Queener. He's going to stuff it. You know, make him move. And that's the other thing Queener's good at. He doesn't move. You need to have a good fake against him, not just a head fake or a quarter turn fake or a wrist fake. You really need to put some mustard on it to get him to move and put the ball around him. He's not a guy that's going to jump out at you, you know? And I think that he showed that in this game, and it's kind of his resurgence, even with his still injured knee.
And then the other big piece of news this week, the MLL releasing its all-star rosters. You releasing your all-star snubs. Got Drew Stubbs on my mind. I'm going to watch the O's play the Indians tonight. What were your headliner snubs?
I think the most egregious one is Tommy Palasek. Really one of the only guys on that Wizards team that produces pretty much every week. At least a goal. He's good for a goal. He doesn't make a ton of mistakes. If he gets stripped on a drive to net, he's the first guy back in the ride trying to get the ball back. I think he's been instrumental in some of their wins. And even in their losses has performed. He's been their most consistent guy. So why not reward him with that? I think Matt Bocklet, not being named to the team is ridiculous. I don't know why you would name guys that, you know, can't really handle the ball to the defensive side instead of him. He's one of the best ball handling long sticks in the league. Like, why not? Why wasn't he named? I don't get it. You know, it didn't make any sense to me at all. Especially when they're naming guys like Mike Manley to be defenders in the All-Star game.
See, I disagree with your assessment of Manley. I do agree with both Bocklet and Tucker Durkin. And I haven't seen all of Rochester's games this year, but I think I've seen three. And he's impressed me.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. Okay, I just look at them it's like a unit. And I just think they're a good unit. You know what I mean? That's why I think
Joe White belongs there.
Yeah, but he's doesn't even get a chance most of the time to go back and play D because they lose the ball in transition a lot. You know, he doesn't get a chance to get on. He's not playing deep. You know, I think their deep guy. I think Lade is better than Manley. Personally, I think Lade is better than Manley. But I mean, I get it. Like, why not put the guy that, you know, he's got a couple big hits on highlights or whatever, and he's, you know, guys don't like playing against him. I mean, that's how you get votes, you know. It's players and GMs and coaches voting. It's not, you know, guys like us. So that's why some of these selections are in there, and I get that. But, you know, I want to see an entertaining game. What's Mike Manley going to do to entertain me?
I mean, entertain. Hopefully not knock somebody out.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what I'm thinking. You know, like, entertain me. Do something. You know, like, that's why I think guys like Bocklet and White belong in there. Because they can at least, you know.
That's a fair point.
Bring the ball up.
The question is, do you build an All-Star game to be an entertaining product in and of itself, or is it a reward for a good performance?
Well, in a spectacle like this where you have, you know, the drafting again, which I liked a lot when they did that, what was that, 3 years ago? I enjoyed covering that and seeing it, and I think it's a cool experience for the fans as well. I think you want the most entertaining guys. That's all. And I just, you know, in that environment, in that when you're picking that, I think that's what you want. In the other formats they've used, I don't think it would be as successful, and I could see the merit alone being the measure. So.
Anything else you want to talk about as far as the All-Star game?
I wish I could go.
Sorry,
but
buddy.
I can't. It's cool. I'm not bitter about it.
Skills competition? Hardest shot?
Have they announced the competitors yet?
No, I don't think so.
No. I mean, you know, Queener's always going to be in there, right? I mean, he's just nuts. He ran in off of like a tractor last year. You know, who knows what he could do? I'm sure Buchanan's going to do something. Because, you know, they keep showing the highlight of him and when they had the All-Star game at Harvard Stadium, stepping over two guys' backs and then balancing on the crossbar and dunking it in. I'm sure he'll do something.
What they don't show is the busted face he caused in his aftermath.
Yes, true. And his first failed attempt, by the way. I was on the field for that.
Yeah.
Awesome.
But those two things correlate, though, because the issue was the weight on the goal, and then it was the the person who provided the weight on the goal that took the goal. Yeah.
Goal to the face.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That was pretty tough. And a lot of people didn't even notice that, but at the time watching it, it was pretty tough, but whatever. I think the All-Star game is probably better than any other event that the MLL holds. And, I think people should, if you can't go down and see it, you should at least watch it on TV, DVR it. I'm sure someone's going to do something awesome, and I'm sure they won't have nearly as many technical difficulties as they had last year, because they've already done games there, in Charlotte. I don't know if you recall, last year's All-Star game was a bit of a disaster with the audio going out.
I recall. Halfway. I wasn't able to watch it, as I was at the Under Armour game at the same time, but yes, I do recall.
Yeah. So, you know, good news is that's, you know, 99.4% not going to happen again. So everyone should tune in and give it a chance. It's in many ways the best thing they do, including the skills competition and you know, the players being accessible to fans. I think it's great, and I'm glad that Charlotte has a chance to host it. It's a great venue. Yeah.
Anything else for the MLL podcast for this week, Kyle?
Well, people giving me crap about the shout-outs and stuff. You know,
who is giving you crap about the shout-outs?
You know, my family, they want shout-outs, but they're not getting them, whatever.
is it one of those rules where, like, you can't request a shout-out?
Yeah, you can't request a shout-out. That's ridiculous. So I'm going to give it out to one of my friends, Vinny Ricasio, owner of Art of Lax. Not to give him free plug. I'm sure that this ad space is very valuable. But, you know, got to talk to Vinny this week. He's doing big things. Artoflax.com. Check him out. He's a good dude. Does a lot of those portraits that you guys see with, you know, pencil and as well as canvas. So shout out to Vin.
Nice job.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll talk to you next week.
Good podcast. Cool. See ya.
See ya. Inside the Cross Podcast.